war on Gaza as the regime continues to pound the blockaded territory with air and artillery strikes. At least 8 Palestinians, including women and children, were killed after the Israeli warplane struck a residential building in Jabalia, north of Gaza. Fatalities were also reported after Israeli forces opened fire on Palestinians in El Mawasi refugee camp near Rafah, southern Gaza. Israeli strikes on Al-Shukra area, also near Rafah, left at least one fatality. According to the health ministry, nearly 90 Palestinians have been killed in a series of Israeli strikes in 24 hours. The new fatalities bring the death toll from Israel's renewed aggression on Gaza since March the 18th to 830. The overall death toll from the regime's genocide since October 2023 now stands at over 50,180, with more than 113,800 others injured. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned that the Israeli captive will return in coffins if the regime uses force to free them. Hamas said the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is lying to the families of the captives when he claimed that the military option is capable of bringing them back alive. Hamas has also said Israel's resumption of its genocide is an attempt to thwart the ceasefire agreement, holding Netanyahu fully responsible for the ceasefire agreement's failure. The group also reiterated its call on the international community and mediators to pressure the Israeli Prime Minister to halt the aggression and return to the negotiating table. While Israel is well known for its systematic killings of journalists in order to silence voices exposing atrocities against the Palestinians, the regime has added another page to its dark history by assassinating Oussam Shaabat, a prominent journalist and activist in Gaza. His death has sent shockwaves across the Palestinian community. Gadda Ibrahim has more details.
The Israeli regime has long record of intentionally targeting journalists, a tactic used to silence those exposing its war crimes and human rights violations. In the past 17 months, 208 journalists have been killed by Israeli occupation forces. Assassination of journalist Hossam Shaabat is the latest crime.
Hossam was wearing his press hamlet and vest committing to the safety and journalism standards. However, he was hit by an Israeli missile. Hussam was documenting the Israeli bombing and crimes against his people. That's why he got killed. Surely, as journalists, we appeal to the international community to stop the killing of the journalists.
Known for his relentless efforts to expose Israeli war crimes, genocide, and human rights abuses perpetrated against the Palestinian people, Shaabat's killing underscores a disturbing pattern of violence directed towards the press by the Israeli forces to mute any voice calling for justice.
The Israeli occupation deliberately targets the journalists in Gaza since the beginning of the war. Hussam and Mohamed Mansi were killed on the same day, mounting the journalists' death toll to 208. That is an additional proof that the Israeli regime does deliberately and systematically kill the journalists. Prior to his assassination, Hossam was threatened by the Israeli army.
I documented the horrors in northern Gaza minute by minute, determined to show the world the truth they tried to bury. I slept on pavements, in schools, in tents, anywhere I could. Each day was a battle for survival. I endured hunger for months, yet I never left my people's side. That were his last words on X. Shaabat's assassination is a stark reminder that the Israeli regime continues to be engaged in a genocidal campaign against the Palestinians, one that seeks not only to annihilate their bodies, but also to erase their voices. Gadda Ibrahim, Gaza City.
A medical charity has sounded the alarm over the water crisis in Gaza, saying the remaining water system in the besieged strip will completely collapse if full supplies run out. Doctors Without Borders said the lack of access to safe water is already having dire consequences for Palestinian health. The MSF said the sheer number of children with skin diseases is the result of Gaza's destruction and blockade, adding that the kids are unable to bathe. It also said that such preventable skin diseases like scabies can lead to infections in severe cases. And a press conference has been held in the Russian capital Moscow on Tuesday. It was dedicated to the International Quds Day that will be marked coming this Friday in a show of solidarity with Palestinian people. Marina Katronova has been at the presser and sent us this report.
Iranian and Palestinian ambassadors to Russia have attended a press conference in Moscow, which was held ahead of International Quds Day. According to the Palestinian ambassador, five more European countries, including Spain, Belgium, Ireland, Norway, and Slovenia, have recently recognized the state of Palestine.
Many countries are already boycotting Israeli products, and Palestine is calling on other countries to follow suit. Some countries, such as Ireland, are taking a bold and decisive stance. We are seeing changes in the mood of European parliaments in Italy, Brussels, and elsewhere. Even in the US, there are shifts, although it will take time.
Nafal spoke of the need for a new world order in which Russia and China would play a more significant role.
We need a new world order based on justice and freedom. What has been happening in Gaza for 17 months is one-sided aggression. Where is the peace? Where is the international community? Where is freedom and justice? We call for actions that will lead to real change and justice for all.
Iran's ambassador to Moscow emphasized the importance of solidarity with the Palestinian people at a time when Israeli crimes against them have reached an unprecedented level. Kazem Jalali also said that the ongoing resistance in different areas of the West Asia region is spontaneous.
It was the occupation that shaped the resistance in the region. The West claimed that resistance groups or proxies of Iran is being raised with the aim of erasing the resistance. As Iran's leader pointed out, using proxy for resistance groups is a completely incorrect term. Attributing this claim to our country is due to the anger of the Israeli regime.
International Quds Day is an annual event marked on the last Friday of the Muslim holy months of Ramadan. On this day, people hold rallies across the world in a show of solidarity with the Palestinian people who live under Israeli occupation. This year's rallies are significant as Israel has intensified its aggression against Palestinians both in Gaza and the occupied West Bank.
Commemorating Al-Quds Day is even more important today as Israel pushes with its plot to kill or expel Palestinians and extend its occupation on the Gaza Strip. Al-Quds Day is a reminder for all freedom seekers of the world who stand against any oppressions to establish justice. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman condemns the killing of a large number of children since Israel resumed its genocidal war on Gaza. In a social media post, Ismail Baghaei said Israel committed the biggest massacre of children in its eighth decade of criminal existence by killing over 180 Palestinian children in a single day. Baghaei noted that the world's public opinion has realized that Israel's massacres of children in Gaza is a systematic and intentional policy aimed at ethnic cleansing. He added that the Israeli regime continues to commit genocide and war crimes with all-out support and complicity from the United States, UK, and some other Western states. The spokesman slammed inaction by the UN and human rights institution as well. Baghaei called on the world to come to its senses and rise up to what he called the most brutal oppression in contemporary history. The Israeli military incursion and deadly attacks in Syria's Daraa province on Tuesday have forced many residents there to leave their homes. A released video showed that women, children, and the elderly are among the Syrians living the town of Koya. The displacement comes as Israeli artillery shelling killed at least seven Syrian people in Koya. The attack took place after Israeli forces staged an incursion there. The incursion was met with resistance by the Syrian people in the area. The Israeli military has then been carrying out aerial raids and ground incursion into Syria in an attempt to rob the country of its military capabilities. The number of strikes has multiplied since the overthrow of Syria's former government in December and with the overtake by the HTS militants. The Armenian armed forces have carried out fresh anti-US and anti-Israel operations as the Arab country remains the supporter of Palestine amid an ongoing genocide in Gaza.
The missile, UAV, and the naval forces carried out a joint military operation targeting enemy warships in the Red Sea, led by the U.S. aircraft carrier USS Harry Truman, from which the aggression against our country is launched.
Sari said the attacks on the U.S. warship was in response to the American aggression against Yemen. He said the Yemeni army forces also struck Israeli military targets in the occupied Yafa area with a number of drones, adding that the operation successfully achieved its objectives. The spokesman reiterated that the attacks on Israeli targets will not come to an end
until the aggression on Gaza stops and the siege of the territory is lifted. The operation comes as the U.S. military continues to pound areas across Yemen. According to Yemeni media, U.S. planes bombed the northwestern province of Saada for nearly 20 times in a matter of hours. And U.S. officials in Trump's administration are still caught up in a chat scandal. U.S. National Security Advisor Mark Waltz is now taking responsibility for the leak that exposes sensitive military plans for bombing Yemen. Waltz called the leak embarrassing and admitted to creating the chat group himself on Signal Messenger app. He also blamed Jeffrey Goldberg, a journalist who was accidentally invited to the group chat in which the war plans were discussed. Goldberg said that the U.S. Defense Secretary posted the bombing plan shortly before the first wave of attacks against Yemen on March the 15. The White House has tried to downplay the leak as a minor glitch. Democratic senators, however, have slammed the breach as sloppy and careless, urging intelligence leaders to address the risk to national security. Political analyst Gilbert Doctorow has weighed in on the recent leak of U.S. bombing plans, calling it a proof of the inexperience and incompetence among Donald Trump's appointees.
For such a scandal, is not surprising. The Democrats have been in a state of total confusion. They have been racing to catch up with the flood of new initiatives which the administration of Donald Trump has put out since he took the Oval Office. And here they have something which looks very good because they can attack Trump for the amateurism of his top advisors, that he has not taken people with proven experience. The people with proven experience, Trump already had experience with them in his first administration. These were Pompeo at State and Bolton as National Security Advisor. These were people who were intent on leading the United States into forever wars and stabbing their boss in the back. So it is not surprising that Mr. Trump has avoided the experienced, so to speak, warriors who are in great numbers on Capitol Hill, and has taken people from outside their ranks. The notion that this was proof of the inexperience and incompetence of Trump's appointees was made.
It has been nearly a decade since the Saudi-led coalition launched its military campaign in Yemen with U.S. support. Was started as an attempt to reinstate former President Abdulrah Mansour Hadi, turned into one of the world's most devastating conflicts. Now, years after the ceasefire was reached, Yemenis are still grappling with the aftermath. Abdulatif Al-Washali has a report from Sana'a.
March 25th, 2015, the day when the Saudi-led coalition launched a military campaign in Yemen to reinstate former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi, an ally of Saudi Arabia. The campaign aimed to push the Ansarullah movement back to Saada in northern Yemen as well. With support from the United States, the coalition also sought to establish a buffer zone between Saudi Arabia and Yemen.
When the Saudi-led aggression against the Yemeni people began in 2015, it had no clear objectives. However, when the aggressors realized they were entangled in this war, they declared an official goal through a meeting at the United Nations Security Council and Resolution 2216, which was to reinstate Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi to power. Yet they failed to achieve this goal, along with all the objectives they had set for their coalition.
The United Nations estimates that the war in Yemen has killed 337,000 people by the end of 2021. The deaths include those caused by both conflict and indirect causes, such as hunger and preventable diseases. According to UN officials, the indirect causes were to blame for the majority of the deaths, as the Saudi-led coalition maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen, a country dependent on international aid to meet its basic needs, even prior to the war.
As the 10th anniversary of the aggression against Yemen arrives, the blockade continues to severely impact the healthcare sector, causing immense suffering due to the ongoing restrictions on medical supplies. During the years of aggression,
airstrikes have targeted 55% of the healthcare sector, rendering 98% of medical equipment non-operational, as we have been unable to repair them or secure spare parts.
The years-long war also devastated other key infrastructure, including airports. The airstrikes, coupled with the crippling blockade, created what the United Nations called the world's worst humanitarian crisis, leaving millions struggling for basic necessities.
There have been many tragedies over the past 10 years of the blockade, both in humanitarian terms and in material losses. On the humanitarian side, there have been significant losses of lives, especially among patients with critical illnesses who needed to travel for treatment but were prevented due to the airport closure. In addition, many students were unable to continue their studies, and tourism came to a complete halt, inflicting severe losses on the national economy.
Archaeological sites were not safe from attacks either. According to a 2019 report by the UN's cultural agency UNESCO, Yemeni cultural heritage sites were heavily affected, mostly through collateral damage. Following years of deaths and destruction, a ceasefire was agreed on April 2, 2022 under UN sponsorship. But while the fighting has largely stopped, Yemen's economic crisis continues, and the struggle to rebuild remains an uphill battle.
Even with a ceasefire in place, the scars of war are still visible across Yemen. Families who lost everything now face the challenge of rebuilding their lives amid an economic crisis. For many Yemenis, the road to recovery is far from over. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana.
And with our report from Abdulatif ends this World News Bulletin. Thank you so much for staying with us. Bye for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
Palestinians will stay on their land because to abandon it would be to betray all those who walked before them. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, U.S. President Donald Trump, never one for historical nuance, says the best plan for Gaza is to level the site and get rid of the destroyed buildings, paving the way for an American takeover and redevelopment project. Reform UK leader Nigel Farage has made equally ignorant remarks, imagining a Gaza with casinos and nightlife, speaking with the casual entitlement of a colonizer who believes history begins with his own indulgence. This is the logic of conquest. First, invade and destroy. Then, stand upon the ruins and declare the land empty. The long, blood-soaked tradition of colonialism speaks through these politicians. Settlers arriving on ravaged shores, massacring the natives, then announcing their discovery of a terra nova, a land with no past. But Gaza is not empty. Gaza has never been empty. What is unfolding before the world's eyes is not just war, but cultural genocide, a calculated attempt to erase Gaza's past so that its people's claim to the future can be denied. The Zionist regime's assault has targeted not only the living, but history itself. More than 200 heritage sites have been obliterated, not by accident, nor as collateral damage, but through a deliberate campaign to sever Gaza from its own past. Empires rose and fell. Byzantines built churches, Ottomans raised mosques and madrasas, and the Crusaders seized Gaza only to be repelled by Saladin, who went on to liberate Al-Quds. In Gaza was born Al-Shafi, one of Islam's greatest legal scholars, whose longing for his birthplace never faded. He once said, "I yearn for the land of Gaza, though after our parting, silence betrays me." Yet now, amid the relentless Zionist American assault, a Fox News host dismissed Gaza's Palestinians as uneducated, parroting the same colonial rhetoric that has always been used to justify genocide. The aim is clear: dehumanize the Palestinians of Gaza, make them seem primitive, incapable, unworthy. By reducing them to nothing, the world is led to believe that when they are wiped out, no great loss has occurred. But the truth exposes the lie. Palestine has one of the world's highest literacy rates at around 97%. Before this war, Gaza had 12 universities that produced world-class scientists, doctors, engineers, and thinkers. All of these institutions have now been destroyed, because an educated Palestinian is a threat, not to the world, but to those who wish to see them erased. In addition to targeting Gaza's schools, Israel has systematically killed academics, scientists, and scholars. The Zionist regime army has killed more than 90 university professors, along with hundreds of teachers and thousands of students. Gaza is not just a city. It is the backbone of Palestinian national identity. After the Nakba of 1948, when 750,000 Palestinians were driven from their towns and villages to enable the creation of the fabricated regime of Israel, Gaza became the last refuge for hundreds of thousands of people. From its camps and streets emerged the leaders of the Palestinian struggle. In Gaza today, a young boy sits amid the ruins, his small frame warped by the devastation around him. His voice rises, clear, unwavering, and beautiful. He sings, "My homeland, my homeland, my homeland is who I am." His poignant words cut through the silence, carrying decades of struggle and resilience. He's not just singing, he's declaring an unbreakable truth. Palestinians are the land. To erase one is to erase the other. The destruction of Gaza did not begin on October 7, 2023. It was always part of Israel's Western-backed plan. Two decades ago, Israeli strategist Aaron Sofer gave a chilling prescription for Gaza's future, saying, When 2.5 million people live in a closed-off Gaza, it's going to be a human catastrophe. Those people will become even bigger animals than they are today with the aid of an insane fundamentalist religion. The pressure at the border will be awful. It's going to be a terrible war. So if we want to remain alive, we will have to kill and kill and kill. And day, every day. First, the Zionists sealed off Gaza. Then they starved it. Now they are trying to wipe it out. Trump's vision for Gaza is one of a colonial exterminator. This vision is not satisfied with mere death, the flattening of homes, the crushing of hospitals, or the silencing of classrooms where futures once took root. It is not enough to bomb the living. This vision seeks to erase the dead, to turn Gaza into a void, a land with no past, no memory, no people. This is the same cold calculus that justified the slaughter of millions of indigenous people in the Americas. The same ruthless hand that wiped ancient nations from the earth in Australia, always in the name of civilization and progress. Cities were turned to dust, languages swallowed by silence, histories rewritten by the conqueror's pen. Every shattered monument, every torn manuscript, every silenced voice is part of an old, familiar crime. One that does not merely kill, but also denies that there was ever anything there to kill in the first place. In Gaza today, a middle-aged man sits in silence on the ruins of his home, the dust of destruction clinging to his skin. When asked why he does not leave, why he remains in the shadow of devastation, his answer is quiet but unshaken, saying, "My son has died here. His blood was spilled here. His bones lie beneath this rubble. Sitting here, I feel close to him." In that single sentence lies the weight of 1,000 untold stories. To the world, Gaza is just debris, ruins to be cleared away. But to the Palestinians who live here, it is sacred ground where memories breathe beneath the dust, and the laughter of the departed lingers in silence. How can they abandon what little remains of their loved ones? How can they walk away when every shattered stone is a tombstone? The people of Gaza do not stand only upon the ruins of their homes. They stand upon the ruins of a stolen history, upon the memories of cities and villages wiped from the earth to make way for another's dream. A land without a people, they were told. "There were no such thing as Palestinians," declared former Israeli regime Prime Minister Golda Meir, a woman who herself had carried a Palestinian passport before the regime of Israel was born. "To be exiled is one crime. To be erased is another. And that is why Palestinians stay. Because to leave is to surrender to the lie. To allow history to be rewritten in their absence. They stay because every stone, every street, every ruin whispers their name. And to abandon it would be to betray those who walked before them. The world must not allow this cultural genocide to succeed. Gaza must be restored, not erased. Gaza is not ruins. Gaza is not nothing. Gaza is human heritage."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of RIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Mahdi Rastani.
Tonight, inshallah, we want to take some time to delve into the justice of Ali ibn Abi Talib. The narration says someone came and made a claim against Ali. This is while he's Khalifa. Made a claim against Ali, yes? This wealth belongs to me, it doesn't belong to Ali. So he went to the judge. And of course, the judge is appointed by Ali. So the judge was standing there. This person came, he told his story. The judge said, "Oh, Fulan," told him his name. "Tell me what happened." He said, "Yes, this wealth belongs to me. It doesn't belong to Ali," and all of this kind of stuff. The judge then turned to Ali. Now imagine, this is technically his boss that he's bringing to court. So he turned to Ali, he said, "Ya Aba al-Hasan, why don't you tell us your side of the story? Go and stand beside this man who's making this claim against you and tell us your side of the story." And all of a sudden they saw Ali's frustrated. He's not happy. He said, "What happened, Ya Ali? It's not a problem." He said, "No, I'm not upset that you asked me to go stand beside this man. I'm upset because when you called his name, you just used his name. When you called me, you used my title. That is for showing affection. That is for showing praise. You're the judge. You're not supposed to speak to people in different ways. You called me, you should have said, Ya Ali. Not Ya Aba al-Hasan. Of course I'm the Khalifa. You're already biased. You can't do that." This is the justice that Ali used to try to implement within society. When it came to his own lifestyle, he used to say in his khutbas, "If I wanted to, I could have had the best of lifestyles. I could have had the best and the finest of silk as my clothing. And I could have had the best of water brought to me and the best of crystals that I could drink from. And I could have had the best of meals prepared for me, the chicken and the meat that you all eat." He said, "I could have had that for myself too if I wanted to take from Baytul Mal extra." Yes, injustice. He said, "But you know why I don't do this? I don't do this because I don't want to meet the Prophet on the Day of Judgment and he looks at me and he says, 'You betrayed one of my ummah.' He said, 'I would rather sleep on a bed made of the thorns of the desert than to meet the Prophet and he looks at me and he says, 'You took wealth from one of my nation.'" This is Ali. This is the one who you and I almost cannot even understand. His justice seems extreme to us. But Ali kept explaining why he was so sensitive on this issue of justice. He said, "You know why I don't take from the wealth of the yatim or ghayrul yatim or non-yatim?" He said, "Because every time I want to take from the wealth of a yatim, I want to do injustice to someone, I am reminded by this body of mine that's already falling apart. I'm not going to be here forever. My body's already falling apart. And I'm reminded of that place that I'm going to go under dirt and I will remain there forever. And even if I live a long life, at the end of the day, I'm going to have to meet God. Every time I want to take from the wealth of this person or that person, I am reminded of this." So we read these lines of Ali. And we say, "Mashallah, wonderful, what a great imam. He never took from the wealth of anyone." But the problem is, injustice is not just taking from the wealth of others. Injustice is when you trample on the rights of others. Sometimes it's wealth. Now you and I might live in a part of the world where, alhamdulillah, we live comfortable lives. Our test is not always wealth. And for most of us sitting here, the majority of us, our test is not wealth. the majority of us, our test is how we treat each other. So I ask you, you look at Ali, he says, I don't touch this wealth because it reminds me of this body of mine that's already falling apart. I already know I'm going to have to respond and answer for what I do. So I ask you now, yes, is it justice in our houses, in our communities, in our cultures? Is it justice this wife comes into the house, she gets married, wonderful, yes, the wedding with the 34 other ceremonies that we typically have for the weddings. Is it justice she comes into this house and then all of a sudden she's responsible for A to Z in this house? She has to wash, she has to clean, she has to scrub, she has to take care of the kids, she has to do homework for the kids, she has to take care of the groceries, she has to take the kids to the school, she has to do this. Is this justice? Is this what Ali taught us? It's not what Ali taught us. Is it justice in our households? You will find this, and I've heard this many times. Is it justice in our households? This young woman, this young daughter of this household, she has 101 restrictions on her. Where you go, what time you go, who you spend time with, how you do this, how you do that, all of this kind of stuff, yes? And some of these restrictions are valid and they are important. But then this young man in the house, the son in the house, no, alhamdulillah, he can do as he wishes. He can come whenever he wants to come. He can go whenever he wants to go. He can dress however he wants to dress. He can communicate with whoever he wants to go. However you like. Then God forbid this young boy washes one dish in the house. Then all of a sudden, mashallah, your wife is going to be so lucky. I'm here to give you some bad news. He's going to have to do a lot more than just washing one dish when he gets married. And then we say, yes, our youth are not interested in marriage. Well, maybe they've seen something for the past 30 years in their houses. Now they say, I don't want a part of that. That's not the only reason, and I want to be clear about this, but this is definitely one of the reasons. I know that for sure. Is it justice in your house, your mother and father who gave everything for you, their lives, years, then they come and tell you something, then all of a sudden you walk away like you're a king. You slam that door, you walk inside as if you're somebody in this house. Is this justice? Is this what Ali taught you? The God of Ali is the same God that exists today. The rules of God are the same rules. If Ali says injustice brings this type of punishment, it will bring that type of punishment for you and I too. It's not like the rules changed. It's the same God. It's the same rules. It's the same standards. Is it justice, brothers and sisters, in our households? These fathers come home. These mothers come home. All of a sudden, you see in some households, the kids, they start to shake, tremble. Why? What happens? Our parent came home. Because the moment this father or mother comes home, the kids know. All fun is done. Now, the only thing you can do is dodge the bullets of getting into trouble. Why is this here? Why is that there? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? What are you watching? Shut it down. All fun is shut down now, all of a sudden. Terrible akhlaq. Is this justice? Is this what Ahlul Bayt taught us? I come into the house like this, like a king. This is, Ali ibn Abi Talib said, listen, when you're going at it and you are speaking to someone and you're doing injustice to them, remember your body and how it's already falling apart. You're going to be held accountable. The justice of Ahlul Bayt extends to all areas of the life of the human being. Is it justice this husband comes home, he's been providing, he's been doing whatever he can, and then this wife turns around and says, yes, you know, Fulani's husband got them this. If you were more of a man, you would have been able to get this for us. Is this justice? This is not justice. And these injustices, brothers and sisters, I'm not saying it, Ali is saying it, we will be held accountable to these. And if we find these in our homes, the only way to go about it is to repent to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala quickly. Quickly. Why does it have to take you 10 years to then come back and apologize? Why not 10 minutes? This is why Ali kept going back to the issue of justice.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mati.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
Let's listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah. Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. In this segment of the show, The Months of Allah, we're going to talk about famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the Muslim world. Sheikh Sayyid Mutawalli Abdul Al was a very famous and good reciter of the Holy Quran. He was born in 1947. He memorized the Holy Quran when he was young, and he learned the rules of tajweed after memorizing the Quran, and also the maqamat. He first followed the style of Sheikh Mustafa Ismail and Abdul Basit, but later he invented his own style of recitation. The voice of Sheikh Mutawalli Abdul Al is a very clear voice. It is not a hoarse voice, because, you know, some reciters, they don't have the clear voice. Nevertheless, their recitation is very good, but their voice might not be as clear as some other reciters. Sheikh Mutawalli Abdul Al had a very good voice and a clear voice. He also had a very long breath when reciting the Quran. He was able to recite two lines or three lines of the verses of the Holy Quran with one breath. He also had a good lahn. Lahn means using the melodies and maqamat of the Quran artistically. And Sheikh Mutawalli Abdul Al, he was very skilled in using the maqamat. And he had the three registers in his voice. He had the qarar, jawab, and jawabul jawab. Sheikh As-Sayyid Mutawalli Abdul Al believed that a reciter must not imitate the style of another reciter. At the beginning, he said it's okay. But later on, they should develop their own style of recitation. For example, a reciter might begin imitating the style of Sheikh Abdul Basit, but he should not continue, he or she should not continue using that style. He should be able to develop his own style of recitation. And this is what Sheikh As-Sayyid Mutawalli Abdul Al emphasizes. Now let's listen to Surah Ash-Shura, verse 15, recited by Sheikh As-Sayyid Mutawalli Abdul Al.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. فَلِذَٰلِكَ فَذَعْ فَلِذَٰلِكَ فَذَعْ وَاسْتَقِمْ كَمَا
So to that religion of Allah invite, O Muhammad, and remain on a right course as you are commanded, and do not follow their inclinations, but say, I have believed in what Allah has revealed of the Quran, and I have been commanded to do justice among you. Allah is our Lord and your Lord. For us are our deeds, and for you your deeds. There is no need for argument between us and you. Allah will bring us together, and to Him is the final destination.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a number of distinguished reciters of the Holy Quran in a gathering titled Communion with the Holy Quran. This meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on the first day of the blessed month of Ramadan, March 2nd, 2025. Today, in terms of relations with the world outside our own society, the Iranian nation is faced with a vast front of power-hungry unbelievers or hypocrites. This is the current situation. We don't have problems with other nations. Nations are either brothers with each other, or if they aren't, they leave each other alone. It's the power-hungry who meddle in the affairs of countries and nations. Today, we are among those countries that face a broad front of such power-hungry people. How should we deal with them? The Quran contains guidance on how to deal with them. The Quran makes it clear when we should speak with them, when we should cooperate with them, when we should strike them in the mouth, and when we should draw the sword. All of these are clearly outlined in the Quran. Regarding social issues within the society, our relationships, you know that according to Islam, after monotheism, Islamic understanding, and being connected with God, the most important matter in the formation of an Islamic society is justice, social justice. After monotheism, the prophets didn't invite people to anything as much as they invited them to justice. We have problems in the area of social justice, and the solution to this is in the Quran. In terms of our personal lives and our personal condition, we are afflicted with moral and spiritual diseases. Not just us, but all of the humanity today is suffering from these spiritual and moral ailments. People are afflicted with envy, stinginess, suspicion, laziness, pursuing desires, selfishness, and the tendency to prioritize their own interests over those of the society as a whole. These matters exist among us too, although we are an Islamic society. We have made some progress in certain areas, but at the same time, we also suffer from these afflictions. The remedy lies in the Quran.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by his power and brought the sight-giving day through his mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor.